Chapter 15. Departures. Asha wrote Vormir on the board, because leaving it on the page felt worse. The word had arrived through three translation relays, one illegal mast, one medic's steady hands, and a child standing in rain beside a fence of names. By the time it reached Harborview, it had already stopped behaving like information. It behaved like a symptom. People looked at it too long and touched their ribs. Phones lost signal near the conference room. A rolling monitor turned itself on twice and displayed only its manufacturer logo, orange-tinted by a failing backlight. Mina unplugged it after the second time. "If the haunted AV cart starts giving coordinates, I quit," she said. Asha kept writing. Vormir. Source. OVEC/Extraction Site Memorial. Associated findings. Final second clustering. Dead/non-returned co-boundaries. Pressure through unresolved lethal event. Risk. Travel compulsion now named. She did not write, "I want to go." Want was the wrong word. The thing under her sternum did not want. It oriented. It made the room less stable when she faced the wrong wall. It thinned her patience for ordinary hallway sounds. It turned the fluorescent hum over the nurse's station into a far shore she could almost hear if she stopped fighting her own body. Asha capped the marker and placed it exactly parallel to the board tray.
Wang noticed, "That will not make it behave. It made the marker behave. Limited victory." Monica stood near the windows, looking out at the wet helipad. The city was pale under morning rain. She had slept for 90 minutes in a chair and looked like someone who had made a formal complaint to exhaustion and been overruled. "Vormir is not a street address," Monica said. "I know," Asha said. "It is barely a planet, depending on who is describing it. That I did not know." Wang rubbed the bridge of his nose. "Remote, protected by reputation, sacrifice, bad records, and several kinds of silence. There are old routes. Most are dead. Some are guarded by people who prefer dead routes." Mina leaned against the counter with a coffee she had not reheated, because the microwave had sparked when the word arrived. "So no portal?" "No portal from a hospital conference room to a cosmic altar tied to an infinity stone," Wang said. "Specific? No. Important? No." Asha underlined risk once. "Then travel becomes visible. Hospitals, families, immigration systems, off-world authorities, last witnesses." At that name, the room changed temperature without changing temperature. Mina looked at the gym schedule printout Elias had sent 2 days earlier. "His meeting is tonight."
"It was tonight," Asha said. "Now it is in 4 hours. Wang's phone was already in his hand. He moved it. Monica turned from the window. "How?" "Public channel, fringe boards, support center lists, several languages," Wang read, with his face doing very little. That was how Asha knew the news was bad. He used the word. Mina's jaw tightened. "Misclaimed?"
"Vormir."
Asha took the phone. The post was short. "If you have heard the water, do not let them drug the tide out of you. If you have seen the orange horizon, do not let them call it sickness. Vormir is where the debt comes due. Last witnesses gather at St. Bridget's Annex. Bring only what you can carry through a door." Asha read it twice. She could feel Elias in the line breaks. Gentle hands, public certainty, the terrible relief of a sentence that told frightened people their fear had a destination. "He does not have the right to move them," she said. Monica's voice stayed low. "People move themselves when someone names the pressure." Asha picked up the marker again and wrote a new heading under the word. "Departure risks." "Then we reduce harm." Mina laughed once, too sharp. "We are going to reduce harm on cosmic road trip day?" "Yes. That was not a real question." "It has a real answer."
Wang slipped his phone into a sleeve. "I can slow public escalation.
I cannot stop every person who thinks a dream is a boarding pass. Then we start with the people we know, Asha said. Her own hand had written, we, before her mind approved it. Mina saw. You're including yourself in that. Asha looked at the board. Case definitions, event boundaries, names of the dead, a child's word for the shore where cost is counted. It all sat under hospital lights, as if medical laminate could keep the impossible under glass. I am one of the people we know, she said. Mina's face changed, the joke in her left. No, Asha did not turn away. That is not an instruction you can give me. Watch me. For a moment, Wong and Monica became very occupied with other objects in the room. It was the kindest thing either of them could do. Mina put the coffee down. You have been awake for 2 days. You are charting your own dissociation as if that makes it fine. And now you want to leave Earth because a child wrote a bad word in the rain. I want to keep Elias away from vulnerable patients. Try again. Asha pressed her fingers against the board tray until the plastic edge hurt. The truth did not arrive clinically.
If I stay, the pole will keep presenting as symptoms in other people, she said. I will keep treating downstream effects while the source gets louder. If I go, I may be able to observe, intervene, and keep this from becoming a movement built around completing interrupted deaths. Mina waited. And, Asha said, the word scraped out of her. I hear it when I stop moving. Mina closed her eyes. When she opened them, she looked furious in the old loyal way. Then you do not go alone. I was not planning to. That is doctor for yes, I was. Asha's mouth started to move and gave up. Mara packed like she was taking an extra shift. That was the first lie. Trauma shears, spare gloves, 2 tourniquets, compression gauze, flashlight, portable charger, protein bars she would forget to eat. The old habit arranged fear into compartments and zipped them closed. Her go bag sat open on the apartment floor while rain ticked against the window and the siren under everything kept trying to become a voice. She had not been home long enough for the place to forgive her absence.
The mail on the counter belonged to 5 years of someone else's city. Her landlord had kept the unit because emergency worker death paperwork after the vanishing had jammed in probate. Rent relief, union pressure, and bureaucratic pity. Half her furniture had been covered. Half had been used by a cousin who needed somewhere to sleep in year 3 and left a cracked mug in the sink when Mara returned from dust and grief with the same shoes on. Mara put the mug in the trash, then took it out again. People came back and found strangers in their beds. Mara came back and found a mug. She set it on the counter. Her phone buzzed. Dan Keen. She almost let it go to voicemail. The scar under her ribs tightened when she reached for the screen. Yeah? You leaving? Mara looked at the bag. Who told you? My ring. She let out a breath. That is a bad diagnostic instrument. So is half of what's happening, apparently. In the background on his end, someone moved a dish. Elena, probably. Dan had gone home with his wife 2 nights earlier. Nothing had been repaired or forgiven. Still, dishes moved in the kitchen, and Dan was there to hear them. You feel it? Mara asked. Yeah. She sat on the floor beside the bag.
Dan's voice dropped. I thought if I kept my hand on the kitchen table, it would stop. Elena asked why I was gripping it like turbulence. Mara closed her eyes. She could see the ambulance again. Wet road, monitor stutter, Ray Alvarez at the wheel, already gone in the way that mattered. Dan under her hands, trying to live because bodies tried even when the universe misfiled them. Are you going? She asked. Dan was quiet long enough that she heard a fork set down on his end. I don't think so. The answer loosened something in Mara she had not known was clenched. Good. That was fast. You asked. Part of me wants to. That's the problem. Part of you was in the same crash. And the rest? Mara looked at the cracked mug. The rest has a wife in the kitchen. Dan winced into a laugh. She says if I run off to space after being back 3 days, she gets to divorce me in every jurisdiction. Smart woman. Yeah. The silence that followed was not empty. It carried Ray's siren under it. Mara could feel the dead driver at the edge of the call, not speaking, only present in the way a road stayed present under tires. Mara, Dan said. If you hear him out there, I know. No, you don't owe me that. I was going to ask, and then it sounded wrong.
Mara opened her eyes. That was the second good thing Dan had done without knowing it. I'll listen if he speaks, she said. I won't go looking for him. Dan breathed out. Okay. After they hung up, Mara added one more item to the bag, the laminated temporary badge Harborview had issued after the blip intake tables ran out of permanent ones. It had her name and a bad photo and a corner bent from rain. The mug stayed on the counter. She locked the apartment behind her and stood in the hallway while the pull tested each direction. East had become useless. Downstairs, a siren passed on the street, ordinary and urgent and gone. Mara followed it out. Asterisk. Nia Reyes had packed 3 times and unpacked 2x. The first bag was too large. It made departure look planned, which made her want to crawl out of her own skin. The second bag was too small. It made departure look dramatic, which was worse. The third was Tess's tote. Nia found it folded in the back of her closet behind tax folders, a sweater she had never liked, and a shoebox full of things she used to mean to sort. The tote was faded green canvas from a film festival Tessa had dragged her to, because the director was a friend of a friend, and because Nia had been saying no to every invitation that month.
Tessa had spilled sesame sauce on one corner. Nia had complained about the smell all the way home. The stain was still there, 5 years later, brown and ordinary and rude. Nia sat on the floor holding the bag and cried so suddenly she got angry at herself for the lack of warning. Her phone buzzed. Mrs. Kim. Nia wiped her face with the heel of her hand and answered. Hello? You are packing, Mrs. Kim said. Nia looked around her apartment as if the kitchen had grown surveillance cameras. How did you know? Because you answer like a person standing in a mess. Nia laughed once. It came out wet. That's specific. I am specific. Yeah. There was a pause. Nia could hear Mrs. Kim's kitchen radio in the background, low enough that the words blurred. You are going to the place? Mrs. Kim said. Naya's throat tightened. I think so. Do you think it brings Tessa back? No. The answer came quickly enough to be true. Mrs. Kim let the silence check it anyway. Do you think it makes her forgive you? Naya gripped the tote, the sesame stain pressed under her thumb. No. Good, Naya swallowed. I don't know what it does. Better answer.
That almost broke her again.
Nia looked at the open drawers, the clothes, the toiletries, the photocopy of Tessa's hospital record she had folded and unfolded until the crease had started to split the date. I keep thinking if I stay, I'm making the safe choice, Nia said, but it doesn't feel safe. It feels like standing in the crosswalk forever. Mrs. Kim's voice softened without becoming gentle. Come here, before you go. I don't have time. You have time to receive food. Mrs. Kim, you come here. You take food, you take dry socks. You do not go to a death planet with convenience store crackers. Nia closed her eyes. The laugh hurt. Okay. And Nia. Yeah? Do not carry my daughter for me. Nia stopped breathing. Mrs. Kim continued, each word placed down like a bowl on a table. You carry what is yours. I carry what is mine. If Tessa is there in some way, you say hello. You do not promise more. Nia pressed her hand over her mouth. Okay, she managed. Good. 20 minutes. I made rice. The call ended. Nia sat there with Tessa's tote across her knees until the command inside the pole softened into an ache behind a bruise. Then she packed the tote with clothes, a charger, Tessa's record, and an umbrella that had survived the crosswalk because Nia had left it at home that day.
At the door, she turned back. Her apartment looked like someone might return to it. That helped. Sarven was asked to depart under seal. The phrase came through three officials before reaching her in the House of Returning Names. Each version improved the lie. Security transfer. Protective relocation. Witness preservation. By the time Marshal Venat spoke it aloud, the words had been polished enough to show his reflection. Under seal, Sar repeated. Rain fell through the cracked archive roof into the basins arranged along the floor. Each basin answered with its own note. The house had always sounded like a place remembering old storms. Today it sounded like a room full of small drums, waiting for a sentence to begin. Venet stood beside the abacus wall with two Hadron compact observers and one young guard who kept looking at Sar when he thought no one would notice. His sister's strip still hung in the disputed section. Sar remembered. So did he. "You know why this is necessary," Venet said. "I know why you prefer it." His mouth tightened. "You have become a vector for interstellar attention." Sar looked at the observers. Their uniforms were dark green, their hands empty, their eyes trained to count exits. "And a vector must be contained. Escorted, sealed, protected."
"Named by other people," she said. That reached him. Shame crossed Venat's face before practice sealed it away. Irin stood near the rain basin with the broken rim. She had said nothing since the message from Earth arrived. In her hands she held a travel wrap, plain gray, folded into the square used for those who left before their civic naming was complete. Sar had not asked for it. That made receiving it harder. Venat lowered his voice. "If you leave without compact sanction, every faction that wants you will call you fugitive." "They already called me prisoner." "This is not your execution yard." Sar turned toward him fully. He regretted the sentence. She saw it before he could cover it. The fragment inside her stirred. For a moment the room held too many condemned lives. Her own, with the weapon raised, a child from a border colony kneeling beside a ditch, a soldier shot because a commander needed his fear to become law, Ovik under stone, Nia in headlights. The categories pressed against one another until Sar's hands began to ache. She placed both palms flat against the nearest table. "Wood. Rain. Present room. Do not make my death useful to your paperwork," she said. Venat's face closed. The young guard flinched. Irin stepped forward and offered the wrap. Sar took it.
Inside the folded cloth was a blank name strip. No official script, no council seal, no provisional number. Blank. Sar looked at Irin. "For later," Irin said. "You are assuming there is later. I am making room for it." The House of Returning Names collected the sentence and held it gently. Sar could feel the old walls accept it. Some sentences belonged to public memory before anyone knew whether they were brave or foolish. Venet said, "If you walk out without seal, I cannot guarantee extraction from any jurisdiction that claims you." Sar tied the travel wrap over one shoulder. "I was claimed before." She did not turn the line into a speech. The room did not need one. Her executioners had needed audiences. Sar had learned to distrust sentences that wanted rows of witnesses facing only one direction. She walked to the abacus wall. Each bead represented a returned person whose status had not settled. The wall had grown since her last visit. More worlds had sent numbers. More officials had learned to count the impossible before learning to answer it. Sar moved one bead in the disputed column. Hers. Then she moved it again,
out of the track entirely and placed it on the sill under the rain. The young guard drew in a breath. Venet said nothing. Sar left by the public door.
That mattered. Ovek refused the covered transport. The vehicle waited beyond the service road, with its windows darkened and its company markings painted over. The paint was fresh. Ovek could smell it through rain. Sharp and false. No, they said. Vessel looked from Ovek to the vehicle to the preservation officer who had arrived during the night with three seals and no sense of mud. The transport is secure, the officer said. Ovek held Leth's name strip in one hand and the folded Vormir page in the other. It has no outside. It has windows. Dark windows are not outside. Marek, standing beside the fence, made a small approving sound. The officer tried again. There may be public disorder if you travel visibly. Ovek looked toward the families. They had gathered in rows along the hazard fence, but no one reached through. Red cloth, gray cloth, blue cloth, white. Some strips were new from yesterday's naming. Some were old and wet and frayed. The metal names moved in the wind without order. Ovek's ribs hurt less when the names could move. They know I am leaving, Ovek said. That is why we need precautions. They need answers. The officer looked to Vessa for translation, even though Ovek had used official speech. Vessa did not help him.
The old site keeper stepped forward. Merrick's cap was in his hands again. Ovek wondered if the cap missed his head, or if hands could need something to hold so grief did not spill through the fingers. The transit line still runs to the upper port, Merrick said. The preservation officer stared. That line was decommissioned. The schedule board says descent only. Boards can be wrong. Ovek loved him a little for that. Lorne, the former guard with his badge in his pocket, cleared his throat. Maintenance car runs twice a day. The officer looked betrayed by everyone at once. A maintenance car is not approved for protected minor transfer. Good, Ovek said. Vessa bent near them. It will be noisy. Good. Crowded. Ovek looked at the fence. I know, crowded. Vessa's face changed, but she did not make the soft adult wound sound. She only nodded. Before they left, Ovek walked the fence once. They touched Tav's strip, Marn's, Savet's, Ney's, Kesh's, Joran's, Halu's, Leth's last. Leth's strip still said nothing. Ovek tried to be angry at it and could not. I speak, they whispered. The fence clicked. I hold. The answer came from the living this time. Vessa behind them. Merrick. Someone in the family rose. Then more. Uncertain and uneven.
I carry, Osavek said. I remember. The voices were rough. Some spoke old Rite words badly. Some used company speech because that was all the dead had been allowed. It still counted. Osavek decided it counted. I release. I return. The final answer moved through the fence and did not enter Osavek's mouth. They stood with their hands at their sides, surprised by the space inside their own body. Then they walked to the maintenance line with Vessa, Marek, and Lorne behind them, carrying no sealed custody order and no company blanket. Elias Crow set out chairs until there were not enough chairs. That pleased people. He wished it did not. St. Bridget's Annex had once smelled of crayons, floor wax, and old paper. Now it smelled of wet coats, coffee, panic, and the relieved sweat of people who had found a room where no one laughed at the word they had been afraid to type into search bars. The last witnesses had grown beyond the gym. People stood in the hallway. Someone had opened the side door. Rain blew in and spattered the first row. Elias left the door open. A closed door made people ask who controlled it. An open door made them believe they had chosen the room.
He moved through the crowd with a legal pad and a pen, writing names, symptoms, locations, transport needs. He touched shoulders only when people reached for him first. He accepted no offerings, except information. He refused the woman who tried to give him her wedding ring because she thought she would not need it where they were going. "Keep what still belongs to your life," he told her. She cried. He hated that the answer worked. Jonah Mills watched from under the table. Only sometimes, Elias knew that. He knew enough clinical language to understand intrusive images, trauma recurrence, guilt hallucination, and all the useful little shelves where professionals placed the dead so the living could walk around the room. Still, Jonah watched. Small knees, blue jacket, one shoe untied, eyes wide because Elias had told him to hide well and then vanished out of the bullet's path. Elias wrote another name on the pad. Harriet Solis came to him near the folded mats. "My son says I shouldn't go." "Is your son here?" "Outside. He won't come in." "Then hear him before you decide." She frowned. "I thought you said this was where we find the answer." "I said Vormir is where the debt comes due." "That sounds like an answer." Elias stopped writing.
The room's need pressed against him. Orange water, backward counting, phantom injuries, crosswalks, hospital ceilings, a bullet, a mine, a courtyard. So many final seconds, all of them leaning toward him, because he had made himself into a listening place. Ovek's words, forwarded through three channels and one angry doctor, had reached him that morning. He wants all the rooms to be one room. The child had named a danger. Naming it did not stop him. Elias looked at Harriet. "No one should come because I said a beautiful sentence." She blinked. "Come if staying is turning you into someone you cannot keep alive," he said. "Stay if someone at home can still hold your hand without making you smaller." Harriet's face crumpled. She went outside to her son. Elias watched her go with a grief so plain it almost felt like grace. Then a man near the bleachers stood on a chair and began chanting Vormir. Others picked it up too quickly. "Vormir, Vormir, Vormir." The word became a staircase. Elias closed his eyes. For 1 second, he could have stopped it. He could have raised both hands and said no, said wait, said we are not ready, said a destination is not a doctrine, said the dead do not become kinder because a crowd speaks for them. Then the pull moved through the gym.
Every face turned toward the open door. Elias opened his eyes. Jonah was gone from under the table. Only the dark space remained. "All right," Elias said softly. No one heard him over the chant. He picked up his coat. Monica found Asha in the ambulance bay. Asha had gone downstairs to find Mara and ended up following a pressure change through two corridors, one stairwell, and a door marked staff only that no longer latched properly after the blip repairs. The ambulance bay smelled of rain, diesel, antiseptic, and wet rubber. Paramedics moved through it with the irritated grace of people who did not have time to be impressed by anyone's apocalypse. Mara stood under the awning with her bag over one shoulder. Asha stood beside her with a hospital discharge packet in her hand. "For me?" Mara asked. "No, for me." Mara looked at the papers. "You discharged yourself?" "Against my own medical advice." "That sounds like a conflict of interest." "It is documented." Monica joined them. "Wong has transport to New York." "That's the first leg?" "First controlled leg." "Meaning?" "After New York, controlled becomes aspirational." Asha folded the discharge packet until it fit in her coat pocket. "Where is Nia?"
"On her way with food," Monica said. Mara's eyebrows lifted. "Mrs. Kim," Monica said. "Good." The word came from Mara, with no irony. Asha remembered Tessa Kim's file, the voicemail, Naya's face when she realized the dead could be connected without being returned. Asha trusted that kind of authority more than half the badges now involved. Mrs. Kim packed rice and dry socks and told the living what they were not allowed to steal from the dead. Wong appeared at the far end of the bay without a portal, carrying two paper grocery bags and wearing the expression of a man who had lost an argument with logistics. Mina was behind him. Asha's chest tightened. "No," she said. Mina held up one hand. "I'm not going to Vormir. I am going to the airport, the New York handoff, and the point where you tried to forget humans need water. Then I am coming back and making sure your job still exists, or writing insults in your personnel file until someone preserves it out of fear." Asha stared at her. Mina shoved one grocery bag into her arms. "Protein bars that do not taste like compressed chalk. Electrolytes. Actual socks. A printed medication list because your charting is illegible when you're pretending to be fine." "My charting is never illegible." "I said pretending." Mara looked away, giving them privacy by pretending to check her phone.
Monica did the same. Wong did not pretend. Wong inspected the rain as if it had submitted paperwork incorrectly. Asha held the bag. "Thank you," she said. Mina's mouth twisted. "I hate this. I know. I hate that I believe you need to go more." That stayed in the bay after she said it. An ambulance reversed in, lights washing red across the concrete. For one breath, the wet floor held the color like sunset on black water. Mara went still. Asha felt it too, the pole recognizing its own language. Wong said, "We leave before the last witnesses move as a group." "Human authorities?" Mara asked. "Among others." Monica's attention sharpened. "Adam?" Wong's mouth tightened. "Not if we stay quiet." "Too late," Monica said. She held up her phone. The screen showed shaky footage from St. Bridget's Annex, people pouring from the gym into rain. Some laughing, some crying, some carried by friends. Elias at the side door, not leading from the front, which made it worse. The crowd moved around him as if he were the hinge. Mara swore under her breath.
Asha's clinical mind counted visible impairments, probable panic episodes, medication needs, mobility risks, vulnerable adults, at least two minors. Her body counted something else, final seconds. Too many of them, drawn into motion before anyone had built a way to keep them alive. "We need to intercept them," she said. "We need to beat them to the next choke point," Monica said. Mara adjusted her bag. "Then let's move." Nia arrived in a rideshare that braked too hard at the curb. She got out with Tessa's green tote over one shoulder, a paper sack in both arms, and wet hair stuck to her cheek. She looked terrified and fed, which Asha decided was better than only terrified. "Mrs. Kim made too much," Nia said. Mina took the sack from her. "Impossible. Give it here." For a moment, all of them stood under the ambulance bay awning with bags, rain, bad coffee, hospital light, and the word Vormir moving under their feet. No one looked ready. That helped Asha more than readiness would have. Wong opened a portal then, small and low at first, a controlled circle of gold sparks widening against the gray bay. Through it, Asha saw no cosmic altar, no cliff, no orange water. She saw a storage room in New York, with labeled shelves, a mop bucket, and a very annoyed security uniform stepping out of the way. Mina laughed.
"First stop is a closet?"
"Secure staging room," Wong said.
"Closet. Walk."
Mara went first. Nia followed with Tessa's tote pressed tight against her hip. Asha stepped to the threshold and felt the survivability line flicker under her skin. The old operating room. The falling weight, the clamp that had not returned because it had never belonged to her body, the cold certainty that repair had ended. Mina squeezed her shoulder once, contact rather than instruction. Asha stepped through. Behind her, in Seattle, rain kept falling on the ambulance bay. In another city, Elias Crow walked into a crowd that had learned the name of its hunger. On another world, Sar left by the public door. Farther away, Ovek rode a maintenance car with clear windows, watching the memorial fence shrink into distance.
The departures started in separate rooms, under different pressures, with no simple agreement between them. On the storage room floor in New York, Asha looked back once before Wong closed the ring of gold.